out of them.
Okay, here's the, read this.
I'd like to bring the House Interim Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Accountability to order. Welcome, committee. September 23rd, Thursday, and I think this is the last day of our legislative interim meetings, and probably potentially your last committee meeting for this September agenda. So I know I am looking forward to getting back to other ventures, and but do have several issues on the agenda today that I'd like to get through. I'm hopefully going to be ending this committee at 4 o'clock, so I'm going to be trying to keep the conversations from going too long. So with that, I will open the informational meeting, and we'll call up a few people for a briefing on state agency background check policies. And we'll have up Gail Parnell, Kim Brokamp, and Bill Buckley, I believe.
Good afternoon.
And so while they're getting seated, committee, with discussion with some of the members on this committee and some questions that were asked previously, was just thought we'd get a kind of an overview of state background check policies for the state, and recognizing that there isn't one consistent policy for all agencies, and there may or may not be good reasons for that. And so hopefully you can enlighten us on some of the overview of your agencies. So whoever would like to go first, if you'd introduce yourself for the record.
My name's Gail Parnell. I'm the Human Resource Director for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, and I'm happy to start. I will add to your comment, Chairman Holby, that there's also different background checks for different jobs, state jobs. So.
Oh, so we're learning something already.
Different levels. So I wanted to be thorough, but wasn't sure how much detail you wanted. So I'll skim over, and you just ask me questions. I thought I would start with our advertisement for a job. Notifies the potential candidates that there will be a criminal background check, that they will be fingerprinted if they're in the public safety program, that there will be an Oregon LEDS check, which is the law enforcement data system check, a driver's license check, that they will have to be able to prove they're a United States citizen and eligible to work for the state of Oregon. So that starts that process when they fill out those forms. Now, until a few months ago, candidates filled out a paper form, and we've just recently switched, the state of Oregon has switched to an electronic system of filling out applications, but they pretty much contain the same information. So a candidate has to disclose their social security number, driver's license number if it's a position that's going to require driving, date of birth, some type of identification that would show they are a U.S. citizen, a passport, Oregon identification, some of those things. They apply, those applications are screened. Many of the jobs have a screening criteria or questions maybe that the candidate has to fill out, so those things are screened and scored. And then people are called for interviews, generally an interview panel, which could or could not include the hiring manager. Then out of those candidates, maybe the top four or five candidates would go forward to final interviews. And that would be with the hiring manager generally and other folks in the organization. Let's see. At that point, those forms are filled out and records sent to the Oregon State Police for fingerprint checking for our public safety positions and any other positions in our organization. that could review those documents. So certainly the HR folks, IT, we have a department called Administrative Policy and Process, and all of those folks that could see these records also have to be fingerprinted and cleared through the Oregon Law Enforcement Data System. We've just expanded that and have an executive order that will allow us to also run all of our employees now through the Oregon Law Enforcement Data Bank System. So a step shy of fingerprinting at the national level, but it will check for Oregon crimes. Let's see. At that point, candidate could be hired. They are notified that if there was any falsification of any type during their interview process, they could be dismissed. They could also be prosecuted, depending on what that information was. Then employees serve, in our public safety program, employees serve a 12-month trial service period, which means they could be removed at any time in that 12-month period without recourse to the union grievance arbitration system. So in that process, when the final candidates are being selected, the manager, in conjunction with human resources, contacts prior employers, human resource departments of those places, and tries to get as much background information as we can as to their actual employment. Our questionnaire also includes behavior type questions. So we're also asking, they get along with people, if they've had any problems in that employment, in the arena of dealing with people or dealing with customers. Now, we had the high-profile case of the person working for us who is who we said he was. And we did a lot of work with the FBI and the U.S. Marshal's Office. They went through our process. We actually asked them to go through our process for background checks and hiring, and they felt that there wasn't a step we could have taken differently that would have given us a different outcome on that candidate. For police officers, the background checks are a little more in-depth in that they do go to neighbors, maybe grade schools, religious affiliations or other types of organizations someone may belong to, and they do a little more questioning in those areas. What they told us about our cases, had we done all of that, which we're not police officers, but had we done that, we would not have had a different outcome because the person had a sterling reputation at each place that he lived. So what caught his falsehood was a new federal system that now matches Social Security numbers with passports. And the Northwest office out of San Francisco is arresting just about 200 people a year through that system. So they're plugging up those holes.
Thank you. I think that was a pretty good overview of your agency, and I think I'll move to the other agencies before we open it up for questions.
Okay. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Buckley. I'm the background check unit manager for the Department of Human Services. DHS is the largest state agency, employing approximately 10,000 state employees, and we do the background check processes for these folks. We also do the background check processes for providers of care in the field. And that's the largest number of background checks that we actually perform in any given month or year. From August of 2009 to August of 2010, we performed approximately 128,750 background checks, all very paper-driven and labor-intensive. We don't have an electronic format for that process. Approximately 20% of the background check processes that we perform are fingerprint-driven. The others go through a process the Oregon State Police Law Enforcement Data System. The reason the fingerprinting takes place for approximately 20% will revolve around either federal mandates, state mandates, certain program mandates, or when we do run the law enforcement data, we find that the individual is a multi-source offender, it's usually flagged on their record, or we note on the application that the person has lived outside the state of Oregon for a particular period of time, during a particular period of time of between 3 and 5 years. So we do the background check processes, and they're very similar, I think, to the Liquor Commission background check process. Generally speaking, we perform what's called a weigh test when we look at an application and there is criminal history or abuse history involved in the application. So there are certain crimes that we consider potentially disqualifying, and they have to go through what's called a weigh test. That weigh test involves looking at the nature of the crime, the relevancy of the crime to the position that the individual is applying for, intervening circumstances relevant to that position, such as the passage of time since the commission of the crime, the age of the individual at the time that the crime was committed, and likelihood for repetition. So we're looking at patterns of behavior there also. We also look at recommendations from employers and what the individual has done to mitigate the commission of that crime in their life. Recent legislation, last legislative cycle, there was a statute that was passed, 443-004, which introduced what we call never never crimes to certain population of folk who are applying to provide care. This particular statute lists a number of crimes that, if committed and on record, the person can not work in the field to provide care. For certain types of facilities, they would include residential facilities, adult foster homes, in-home care agency employment, and home health employment, and any individual who is paid directly or indirectly with public funds who have or will have contact with recipients of care. The background check process also includes an appeal process. If the person is denied or they are restricted, they have a right to appeal that denial or restriction. And so within the background check unit, we have compliance specialists who work as lay representatives to the Office of Administrative Hearings, and they perform the background, or the, excuse me, the appeal process for that, for those people who have appealed the decision as far as a denial or a restricted approval. That comprises approximately, I'm going to say 5% of the total appeal, and 5% of those that appeal will go on forward to hearing. DHS absorbs the cost of the background check process for DHS employees as well as providers of care. We did a study in 2009 to try to find out what the actual cost is per application, and we came up with a figure of about $45 per application. If you multiply that by the 128,000 plus background checks that we did over this last year, you're looking at close to $6 million processing fee for background checks. Fingerprint checks cost considerably more, but we amortized that cost into the overall cost of performing background check processes. A fingerprint background check would cost approximately $60, upwards to $80, depending upon where the person actually had their fingerprints rolled. Through a county sheriff's office, through a private vendor of service, that cost can vary that much. And that being 20% of our background check process, we amortized that into that actual average cost. There are some concerns that we work with our partners and providers of care. Some of the concerns on background check processing would be the portability of that background check process throughout the industry that provides care for our vulnerable population. There are differences in program rule that create subject matter experts in the background check process. Some of those are federal mandates for fingerprints or state mandates for other types of processes that would be involved in the background check. Abuse and neglect reporting for DHS employees and volunteers, for instance, is different. We don't use that, for instance, for the senior population, though we do have statute authority to do so. We have not yet formulated and developed that process with our providers of care. The increasing cost of performing the background check process is definitely a concern. Like I mentioned, DHS does absorb the cost for the most part for those background check processes. But it's a concern to us also because of the monies that must be spent in that very paper-driven and labor-intensive process. That concludes my testimony. If you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to try to answer them for you.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I'd like to hold the questions till we get the whole panel. If you can write it down.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, I am Kim Brokamp. I am the Assistant Director for Human Resources at the Oregon Department of Corrections. A little bit about the Oregon Department of Corrections. We have approximately 4,500 employees across the state. Every year we do about 925 backgrounds. Those are primarily on our security staff, but we do criminal history checks on all new employees to the Oregon Department of Corrections. We also do fingerprints of all employees based on the fact that every Department of Corrections employee has access to a correctional facility. We find that fingerprints and that criminal history background are imperative. For our correctional series staff, we do a bigger background, including a bigger reference check that includes obviously the law enforcement data system, motor vehicles. We check the Oregon Judicial Information Network. We look in our own DOC systems to make sure the applicants are in our system already. We look at military service records, education records, high school diplomas are part of what they must turn in to be considered for application. We also check on our some of our health service and people with professional licenses. We require that they turn those in when we hire those staff as well. Generally, if we have staff with issues with military records, we'll follow up with the military to get clarification on those issues. But based on the clientele we serve and the access to our institutions, we take background investigations very seriously. We do our fingerprinting at our facilities, so we don't have the cost that another agency would have. We have, in a lot of our facilities, we have actually the electronic ability to connect right up to state police and their system. And we do check criminal history on an annual basis to ensure employees who do work in our facilities have not had any trouble with the law during that performance year. At corrections, we have to make sure on an annual basis that our staff, especially our certified staff, are not certified through DPS's teammates. They cannot have a felony or a qualifying misdemeanor crime against them, or they will lose their DPSST certification, which means they cannot be a security staff.
Thank you, and it's probably the advantage of going last is you got to avoid a lot of things that were already mentioned, because they were duplicative. So I appreciate you not repeating all of them. With that, I know that Representative Tomei had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Speaking of duplicating, I'm chair of the Human Services Committee, and in one of our hearings, I'm recalling now that we heard from different employees, from different, not agencies, but agencies that worked in conjunction with Department of Human Services, and they were talking about having to duplicate some of these background checks and wondered if there were some way of sort of dovetailing all those so there could be one background check that would apply to all these various private nonprofits.
Chair Holy, Representative Tomei. It is a continuing process and problem that we deal with on a daily basis. The way the law is currently written, 181537 is our enabling statute. It tells us that qualified entities, which are the residential treatment facilities in the various counties in Oregon, the nursing homes, the assisted living facilities, adult foster homes, and in-home care folks, have the opportunity to become what are called authorized designees for the background check process. And basically, we provide them then with the information from law enforcement to make fitness determinations for their organization. They represent, for instance, an authorized designee from a residential treatment facility in Eugene might fall under Avamere, and Avamere is a large corporation. They can provide fitness determination on background checks for that particular organization. But if the individual wants to work at another residential treatment facility not run by Avamere, they don't do that background check or fitness determination for that facility for probably good reason. When you want to talk about due process and the background check, they don't want to be responsible for making a fitness determination for another agency, for instance, for culpability reasons. But that's the way the law is set up. The other problem that we have is that one residential facility might be licensed by the senior program offices at DHS. The other residential facility will be licensed and certified under mental health or developmental disability licensing offices. They have two separate and distinct administrative rule that governs the background check process for each. One might have a federal mandate for checking certain crimes, the other one might not. And so what happens when they become mobile and they try to move from one facility to the next, they fall into those issues that we have, and therefore multiple background checks for something that they might be doing very similar to one organization. It doesn't necessarily
get rid of that out, I think.
Thank you. I appreciate your explanation, but I think it's too bad because it certainly duplicates the effort, and that's something I know, Representative Riley, that you've worked on.
It is. Could I follow up on that?
Are you done?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Thank you. So what I heard you say, tell me if I'm wrong, is that you provide data for other organizations, outside organizations, and they use that data for determination. Is that correct?
That is correct in approximately 20% of the time.
Okay.
80% of the background check processes are generally done in-house.
Okay, but for those, okay, if you do them in-house, then they should be transportable.
With the exception of the problem of different program rules.
Right, but the data is the same.
The data is exactly the same.
So you could avoid at least that data gathering portion of that in duplicative areas. Is that correct?
We more than likely could, and we do. For instance, if an individual requires a fingerprint-driven background check, we'll ask for one fingerprint card mm-hmm. for them, and then we use that information for a certain period of time. We don't go beyond a certain period of
right.
time, but we can use it to help make fitness determination for the other application that comes through for different facilities.
So I'd like to see you do that as much as possible. I think we're getting it.
Chair Holdy, Representative Riley, I agree with you wholeheartedly there. It's one thing that we do want to work very closely with the different program offices in trying to make that happen. If it were an ideal world, we'd do one background check process, and in my personal opinion, put that individual in a registry of good folk. And any organization that provides care could go to that registry and say, the background check process has been done, eligible, we'd like to hire you. It would be a wonderful thing to have happen, but unfortunately, at the present time, there would be substantial change in statute and other types of program rules that mitigate that from happening.
Yeah, thank you for that. I mean, it was one of the things that I'm sort of interested in is those particular statutes and trying to see if there's an ability somehow for the state to consolidate some of the background checks amongst agencies and recognizing that we're probably not going to get the Department of Corrections or State Police, you know, to consolidate with everybody else because, you know, obvious reasons, but seems like there might be some places where you can find some efficiencies, and this is something that this committee, I think, is interested in seeing, you know, statutorily what we need to do, and practically does some of that work. And so that may be an ongoing discussion.
If it were the ideal world, from my perspective, every application would be fingerprint-driven, and there'd be a process that is called wrap-back. Wrap-back is a process where the actual record is flagged as a provider of care, for instance, or works for a DHS as a provider of care. If the individual is arrested and fingerprinted, which hopefully most arrests that takes place, the fingerprint is the tail of the tape. It's matched with the fingerprint record that's being maintained by the state police, and the agency is notified that this person has been arrested. Now you have something concrete in your hand that you can go back to and say, okay, now we need to look at this individual and see if they still are fit to perform the duties they're performing. One background check process happening only one time for that silo of individuals, and we mitigate the redundancy that we see today. But that's a system. The federal government needs to be involved in that too, and they are. By 2013, they're supposed to have a wrap-back system in place on the federal side of the house. Mm. Oregon does not have a wrap-back system per se. I'm sorry.
Representative Tomei, a question?
I'm sorry. I should know better. How do we do that? How does Oregon do that?
To provide a wrap-back system?
Right.
We need to start working in concert with the state police to develop a wrap-back system. Hmm. There is a funding source out there today. The time has passed, but the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services have offered certain grants to try to develop a wrap-back system in conjunction with other things as far as background check processes are concerned. But it's doable.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I really appreciate that. I know there's probably a few other questions, and I want to keep mindful of the time. I think I saw Representative Wisnant with a question down there, and then Representative Call, or did you have something that needed to be...
No, I was actually going to ask about this topic, so he's basically answered almost all of my questions.
Great. Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I hope you will, or if you haven't, looked at the paper by Ms. Marjorie Taylor from DAS on background checks. 46 agencies are doing them. A lot of good information on there about the cost and everything. Mr. Buckley, would you please tell me, you said the DHS is spending $6 million a year on background checks. Is that correct?
Chair Holby, Representative Wisnant, that is correct.
Thank you, Paul.
Actually, that's the cost for my organization to do business.
Thank you. Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
And Mrs. Brockham? Brockham? How much does corrections spend a year on background checks?
Chair Holby, Representative Wisnett. To do the computerized criminal history check through LEDS, there's a user fee per person for 24 months. So many of our employees have LEDS access for multi-purpose between inmates, for inmate use and staff use. I didn't go through. I have one person specifically in HR for all new applicants who run CCHs on all of our security staff. So that would be $95 a year for 24 months for that person. We also have a three-person background investigation unit that does those extended backgrounds on corrections.
Okay, how much does corrections spend a year for background checks?
Chair, I'll be representing a witness. I will get you a specific number.
Thank you. Follow up, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I want to ask OLCC, Mrs. Parnell, several questions, but I think this is an issue that we still, I think comments are made today about the RAP Act and Representative Tomei's question about duplication and things, and Representative Raleigh. I think there's a lot more here than we probably have time today, and I'll be glad to continue to work on this and report back to the chair and the committee, because I think there's a chance for some savings here and elimination. And that brings me to my questions for Mrs. Parnell. Mrs. Parnell, you said that one of the first statements you made that you in your procedures, the first thing you have to do is establish U.S. citizenship.
Yes, sir.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
And as you know,
you're like an attorney, you know, or a judge.
I'm just trying to. We're going to
continue with your line of questioning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mrs. Parnell, as you know, our situation in Central Oregon with Mr. Evers or whatever his name is, he was not a citizen. That was the issue. So, if that's your first requirement, how did that get missed?
Chair Hovey, Representative Wisnett. The state requires that you provide some documentation that you're a United States citizen. So in this case, Mr. Evers presented a passport, a valid and authorized passport, had an authorized Social Security number and card. And so those systems were missed when he got those documents from the Social Security Administration and from the passport.
Thank you. You also said that someone looked at you. Who looked at the OLCC on this case and said that there was nothing you could have done to turn this up, to rebuild this?
Chair Holvey and Representative Wisnett, we had the FBI agents that we were working with on this case review our process.
Okay. There's another report that said you didn't have the authority from the state to do what you needed to identify this issue as one of the press reports. I don't know if that's correct. Could you comment on that, please?
Chair Holvey, Representative Wisnett, I don't know of any report like that.
It was a Mr. Scott. It was a OLCC employee, Scott Chambers. Does that make sense? But so would you agree with that? That you know, there's not that the state, my question and where I'm leading is, do we need to do something to be sure that we don't have this situation? Is there legislation we need to pass to be sure that this situation doesn't happen in the future?
Chair Holby, Representative Wisnett, I don't know what that would be. Here's why. It took the U.S. Marshals and the FBI about 3 months to determine who this person was. And the only way they determined that was to take photographs of him back to areas where he had gone to school across the country. A school official happened to remember him, and that sort of broke that case for them. But they have said to us they don't know what we could have done differently.
Okay, here's the quote. Christy Scott, a commissioner spokeswoman, said that state statutes prohibit the OLCC from doing as extensive a background check on new employees as you need.
Chair Holvey, Representative Wisnett. I don't know what she was referring to. I know this. I don't have the authority to do the same background check that the Oregon State Police do on state police officers or that a county sheriff's office does on their officers.
But that's our objective. I mean, we're here representing the public, and do we need to have statutes? Do you think you need that? Do you need to be treated like police officers for your inspectors and staff members? Do we need legislation to do that?
Had we been treated like police officers in this case, there would not have been a different outcome. What the FBI said to us is we could have gone to his grade schools, we could have talked to his neighbors, we could have talked to his ex-fiancé's family, and the references would have been good. At no point would we have had a way to crack into his falsification of his documents.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Representative Wisnett. I kind of think she's made her point that with the falsification of documents that were issued by the federal government, it would make it pretty difficult, I think, for anybody to have found this out with the resources we have. Have to have investigators going all over the country looking up on people. That would be pretty tough. But I get your point. Maybe we should all be at the level of the state police for all employees.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that's what we need to look at. Is this one-time situation we're never going to... Because we're spending a lot of money. $6 million a year is 100 teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying we don't need background checks, but we need to be sure we're doing the right kind of background checks for the need and we're not duplicating it and things like that. Because we as legislators have now put 46 agencies here and saying do this and do this. And I was hoping, and I'll go back and talk to the OSP and also DAS again on this to be sure and try to find some legislative solution, because it was very embarrassing. It was very bad for economy and what happened to Mr. Evers. And again, I just want to be sure if OLCC thinks we need to raise the level of background checks and whatever. And because Mr. Chair, what happened here was it was in the the problem was he came over on a student visa. So the State Department, the federal government needs to be looking at this too and identifying people when they come over approved. It's one of the easiest ways to come over and to get out of the system and not people track you. So it's a federal issue too, and I agree with that.
Well, I appreciate where you're going with that, and I'm not even sure the state police would have caught this guy if he had really good falsified documents, but notwithstanding that, I think it's a good thing to look at, and I appreciate the interest in that. But I'm also very interested in how we can get rid of some of the duplication amongst our agencies, and I think there might be some great savings there and make us a little more efficient. So,
thank you.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, I just had one.
Representative Call, I forgot you.
That's okay. I just want to know, I was going to ask about the wrap-back process system. And I guess what I'd like to know is, when we're looking at the cost of duplicativeness and inefficiencies in the system, whether or not those inefficiencies, if we squeeze them out, would create enough of a cost savings to create a wrap-back system. I know you don't have that answer right now, but I feel like, we could look at the short-term investment in creating a siloed clearinghouse that has wrap-back capabilities so that we have information moving forward and it's not just a snapshot at one point in time. And would it pay for itself over 10 years because we'd be squeezing out all of the duplication out of the process? I'd like to see, at what point the system pays for itself by getting rid of the duplication. I know you can't answer that today. I don't need it, Mr. Chair, but I feel like if we're going to continue on this, I'd like to see the cost of the cost effectiveness of it. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll instruct our committee administrator to see if
we
can figure out what the most efficient way to do that is. Actually, I'm not sure. Anyway, we'll check that out. Any other questions, Representative Gilliam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Seems like one of the common denominators is the state police. I wondered if any or all of you would comment on, do you see any possibility for doing more at that level, shifting some responsibility there that would allow you still to do your job, but also cost savings? Are we underutilizing state police ability?
I'd love to answer. Chair Holvey, Representative Gilliam. Currently, our system is similar to corrections. We have a technician in-house that does the fingerprinting, and so there's not a hard cost. There is for some of our field offices. If the potential employee goes to the then sheriff's office, I think they pay $10 for the fingerprinting process. But pretty small cost. But we have been notified that effective all but immediately, those costs are raising to 28, much less than yours, but 28 to 47. And that's dependent on what the report shows. So we fingerprint you, comes back with nothing on it. That's the initial 27. Since there's nothing on it, they send it through a second level, and now it's 47. However, if it comes back with something on it, we stop it at the 27. So, you know, we're a small agency, 240 employees, and so it's not going to be a big cost to us. But it is an increase, and it's certainly going to be an increase for other state agencies. But the state police is the route to do the fingerprint checks. I don't know that it's cost-effective for those folks to go out and do interviews of past employers. They wouldn't know what we're looking for one thing. So other than that, LEDS check, which is an electronic records-keeping, DMV checks, which is an electronic record-keeping system, I don't know what part of that background check they could do for us.
Good question. Any other questions?
I know. It was earth safety.
Thank you.
Oh, shocked you then. So I have
good
one
question. New Year check.
I have one. Sorry, I slipped up there. I have one for you, Mr. Buckley. It's a little bit removed from background checks, perhaps, but because you mentioned a couple scenarios DHS where you're working with providers of care and, for example, you know, in-home health care or something like that. And so these people are registered with DHS, as I assume. And so when you review, I guess, an arrangement for a home health provider to go into someone's home and provide them health, do you have a policy of actually checking your own system to see if they're already providing health care for somebody else? Or, in fact, maybe they're also a foster care parent and perhaps are doing five or six things at one time, and some of those things are providing 24-hour care. So how do they do all of that?
Chair Holvey, we were formed, and I have to just give you a brief history. We were formed as a consolidated unit back in 2001. Prior to that time, each program area conducted their own background check processes. And what we inherited in 2001 were their disparate systems that tracked those background checks. So a person that applies for a mental health facility uses a particular software program to track that information. When they move to the senior side of the house, there's a different database that we have to use because there's been nothing that we've been able to put together because of cost problems. In trying to marry those two together, they're made from different software, they track different things. But to the greatest extent possible, when we receive an application, we go back and we look in those databases to see if they've applied in any of those areas before. Here just recently, we've taken our manual file system and we've been able to electronically adapt a program to where all of our files are now imaged. So now we have one repository where we can go back and look up a name to see if that individual within the last 3 years has applied at different facilities. If they have, again, depending upon the time, because I'll guarantee you that the state police will tell you that a background check is only as good as the moment it was created. given a certain amount of time, and let's just put a tag of 90 days on there, if that individual had applied during that particular period of time, we'll gather that information and try to use it in our background check process, especially if it's a fingerprint-driven background check through the FBI. So yes, we do look at those types of things, and we try as best we possibly can to reduce the burden on the individual by not requiring the fingerprint process again, or if we do have a very recent background check process, utilize the information we've already gathered.
So I'm not sure whether you directly answered my question, but I guess my concern here is that there are potentially providers out there that are being authorized through DHS that I, for a lack of a better term, are gaming the system and have several different cases or that they're handling all at the same time and turning in, you know, authorization for payment for a month's worth of work concurrent while they're doing it with somebody else and also being a foster care parent and, you know, several different things all at the same time. That was kind of where I was going, is a little bit removed from background checks, but just...
Where one individual is actually working in multiple different...
Yes.
Locations. We do see that happening in, especially in-home care providers, because they get background checked through us, are registered through the Home Care Commission, but they pick up their clients independently. And so the background check process for an in-home care provider is good for 2 years, and they can pick up as many clients as they want to.
So they could essentially be working full-time for 5 or 6 different clients.
Yes, sir.
Interesting. Well, I think that concludes this panel. I really appreciate you coming and giving us sort of a primer of background checks and how your departments handle those sorts of things, and giving us food for thought. And I'm hopeful that we'll be able to have another conversation about these sorts of issues and looking for perhaps a more efficient way for at least some of our state agencies to accomplish the same thing. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
So looking for a little diversity committee, we're going to have a little bit shorter presentation on a topic that we have talked about before, and it's involving moisture testing requirements for new structures. And on that panel, first up, I have Pat Allen and Scott Berry. I almost called it Pat Berry and Scott Allen. I don't know where that came from, but
yeah. First time I've ever been a source of diversity, I have to say.
I bet that's true for both of you.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Allen. I'm the acting administrator of the Building Codes Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I promise I'll be really brief. I'm going to talk just very quickly about what we're doing, some of the steps we've taken dealing with moisture in buildings. You passed legislation in a previous session dealing with moisture standards at time of construction. We've implemented that statute as well as done some other things, and I want to talk just quickly about that. We have amended the Oregon Residential Structural Code to incorporate the statutory requirement that structural members have no more than 19% moisture at the time the structure is closed up or that those framing members are covered. That's done through a certification process by the builder. There are standards in code. The builder is then required to submit a signed certification to the local jurisdiction that he or she has complied with that standard. There's guidance available for builders on how they can go about doing that. That's been in lieu of setting out specific standards of how to measure, where to measure, having local jurisdictions do further measurements and those sorts of things. We tried to cut a balance between accomplishing the standard in the statute and creating a regulatory system that would be terribly complex and difficult to administer. It's challenging in dealing with codes, trying to set up a code that deals with a structure that you don't know what the structure is going to be. So trying to identify where would you measure without having an actual building and those kinds of things, it can be a little bit challenging. So what we've tried to do is to have that be a certification process. In addition, we've beefed up codes relating to ventilation in spaces like kitchens and bathrooms. Those are now required to be ventilated, and there are minimum standards of how powerful the fans need to be able to get water, particularly out of bathroom spaces. And then finally, and most recently, we established standards for what's called a drain plane. Up until that point, I think it's fair to say most standards have to do with how you keep water out of a building to begin with and assume that the building is then going to be built correctly. This is a place where we actually kind of took a step to say, well, what happens if the building's not built correctly and water does get in? How does it get back out? And so we established a standard that requires there to be an eighth-inch space between the exterior siding and the interior component so that if water does get into the wall assembly, it then has a way to get back out of the wall assembly. This is based on building materials research done by the National Institute of Standards and Technology. We've established some alternatives that are available so that if various builders have got building methods and materials that work alternately, they can do some different things with flashing, for instance, to work around that. But we've tried to recognize that sometimes buildings don't get built completely right, and what can we do to make sure that they don't fail. And that's kind of a quick rundown of some of the steps we've taken over about the last 3 or 4 years on the moisture issue.
Thank you. Mr. Berry.
Good afternoon. Scott Berry with the Oregon Home Builders Association. And we've discussed this and other issues associated with the task force over the last probably 5 to 7 years. And I know this has been a particular issue of concern. As Pat Allen mentioned, we have now training for contractors. We have mandatory continuing ed, including envelope training on specific issues relating to moisture. We were required to do the moisture testing and certify that it has been done. Typically, those might include using kiln drying lumber, bringing in a company, or actually doing the drying or dehumidifying, which is a big piece of it, making sure that that humidity in the air gets out. That can sometimes take up to a week or maybe longer. But during that process, during the construction phase, rough-in electricals going on, other things, and other parts of the construction process are happening. So it's not a week where we're not necessarily doing anything at all. In addition to that, we've got the moisture meter testing, and again, certifying that has been done. You know, I had talked with folks in our industry, just a brief chance to chat about this issue when I saw the agenda item coming up. We haven't had a board meeting about it with the home builders. We've got one coming up in October where we can maybe talk a little bit more about going through a process of checking off which particular item you may have used. Did you do moisture testing? Was there another company that came in and did some testing or drying and dehumidifying for you? Or did you use kiln-dried lumber? Those are some things that we'll talk about in the October meeting. But I would say we've done a lot so far, and I think part of our interest is in kind of waiting and see how much, you know, with all the things we have done with the building code and with the training, what has that accomplished? Now, we're not building a ton of homes right now, as many of you know, so that may take a little while to determine how much of that moisture issue has been mitigated by steps we've already taken. There's also been some talk about third-party inspectors coming in. And the chair and I have had some conversations about that. Again, we haven't had a whole lot of time to look into that process. We already, in some cases, have folks bring in a third-party contractor to dry the house out and do some of the moisture testing. The concern would be liability down the road and the liability insurance that may be part of that. If the contractor that's doing that can't get liability insurance for mold, I'm not sure we're right back to the contractor again if they're not doing a good job, and yet we have a piece of paper that says it's moisture free. So I think there's still some concerns about that, whether it's a home inspector type person or somebody who's gone through some specific National Association testing on mold mitigation. I think you still have to get back to that issue with the home inspectors, for instance, that are licensed by the contractors board. You're able to have them come in and do a home inspection on your house or even on a new house. But if there's a problem with the house, you've signed something that says they're only liable for the $400 or $500 that they charged for the actual inspection. So those are concerns we wouldn't want to see passed on to something like this. So. Happy to take any questions.
Thank you. I think since I sort of brought this subject matter forward again, we did talk about this exact same thing in last May, I believe, in this committee. Or maybe it was February. Time runs together anyway. So just following up on some of the things that have been said, because primarily my concern is from observation partly, and partly looking at what the task force recommendations actually were and what the rules are implementing. And you say, that they're required to do testing. Actually, they're not required to do testing. They just actually sign a check off a form that the building had 19%, no more than 19% moisture content in the wood framing members. And so my concern with that is that there is actually no way to prove or disprove that particular affidavit, whether or not there was testing or not. And so, and it also kind of begs the question, and it'll be another question that you can answer here in a few minutes, of we're checking wood framing members, and I'm kind of curious what the definition of that is. And some of my observations have been seeing homes built in the middle of winter while it's raining with some products that I would venture to say probably absorbed quite a bit of water. And they had insulation already installed under the floor. And, the place gets sealed up and they keep moving. They don't slow down a whole heck of a lot. And so I'm really wondering whether or not that's an adequate rule to accomplish what the intent of the task force and the legislation actually was. And so I think the proposal of having a third-party inspector for a fee measure actually come in and do the testing and certify that they did the testing, and we can develop where that testing should take place and where it shouldn't, would be useful to a consumer. Quite frankly, I think that it is a little bit questionable about whether or not you can test the framing members, but if it's present soaking wet insulation, it wouldn't seem like the framing members would pass that 19%, but maybe they didn't see the insulation under the floor. And so I'm a little bit concerned about the process of just providing an affidavit that at some point in time it was at 19%, and I think the rule's pretty loose. It's subject to a lot of loopholes. And so the question about the liability, I think, is an interesting one, too. I totally agree that because an inspector comes in and inspects and says, we checked it out, the moisture content was less than 19%, I don't see where that relieves, the contractor of any liability or is even intended to. What it is a step to help make sure that we can prevent moisture from being sealed into the building during construction, and sort of a proactive step to preventing mold and moisture. It's not going to prevent shoddy construction, which may lead to future water intrusion and a problem down the road, but certainly that's another piece that we'll be talking about real shortly. So that is sort of the the goal, I think, that I've looked at, and I've talked to several home builders, and I've talked to some home inspectors, and I've talked to some building officials, and not that I would mandate that any, and I'll put it on the record, I'm not intending to mandate any building official department to absorb the cost of doing inspections for moisture content, but they may be able to do that if my concept of this were to go forward for a fee. And obviously the home inspector would also, an independent home inspector would also, you know, have a fee for doing that. So that's sort of how I lay that out, the thinking behind that, because when I read the rules about how this is verified, how it takes place, and looking at the form that they fill out and signing it, you know, there really isn't any accountability in that system at all that I can see. And my one question for Mr. Allen would be, do you have a definition of moisture-sensitive wood framing members?
A definition specifically of moisture-sensitive versus framing members generally? I don't believe that we do in our own rules, but there may be in code. I would need to check on that.
I would like to get that information back. I haven't been able to find it since it's referenced as that's what you're measuring for the 19%.
This one here.
Would you happen to know the answer to that, Mr.?
Just a couple things. One, on the mandatory testing, I believe my comments were if they were misread, I apologize. But we do have companies that come in, or in fact have members of the association as well as folks outside who do come in and dry the houses, and they do testing. So they do testing and certification of the buildings today. They are contractors like any other contractor. They are licensed, bonded, insured.
If we're not concerned about them,
I don't know, and I'm not sure, but I don't believe they're getting test or insurance that would cover mold issues. In other words, if they don't catch something and it leads to mold later, we feel like we've got a solution to the problem. But if there's no backup to their testing, there's no ability for the contractor to feel comfortable that by having that group come in, that there is no mold in the building down the road. There's no moisture left, I should say, that could lead to mold. And I'm not sure we're getting a benefit here if we're already doing testing or certifying that the moisture level is below 19%. And if we need to change the way the certification language is written to put some more teeth into that, again, selecting which one did you use to mm-hmm. identify that the moisture level was 19% or lower, I think that's fine. From our perspective, the wood sheathing is a framing member. But if we need to, you know, work with Building Codes Division, if it's not already identified, in terms of OSB or in strand board or plywood being used on the flooring, certainly that's a piece of the structure and a part of the framing that is essential to the structure, you know, maintaining its integrity. So I think we would look at it that way. I'm not sure that I've seen a definition that explains that. I haven't looked, but I don't know that there is one out there. Again, with a third party, if we use home inspectors as an example, our folks get real concerned about their liability limit on you know, being able to go after them for only the $400 or $500 they might have charged for the inspection. If you, as a consumer, hire the home inspector yeah. and they find 2 feet of wood, or there's 2 feet of water under your house, and they don't see it because they didn't go to that part of the house or underneath that section of the house, then you know, you can get your $400 back, but that's the limit of what you can go after. So I'm not sure that's always a great value.
I don't want to confuse this with liability insurance issues so much, because currently, who is liable under the current system? Who is liable if mold were to appear?
Chair Holby, it depends on the insurance policy. Some of the builders have insurance that covers mold, and some don't.
Yeah, so it would be the builder's insurance or the builder himself personally.
Chair, that's correct. I guess our concern.
And so I don't see that this requiring an inspection to provide an independent affidavit that the inspection happened and it was below 19% would change that liability at all. All it would be a requirement in the process to help prevent potentially mold down the road. Not that it would be the liability of the inspector. So that, I mean, that's, we can not get into the weeds on this yet, but we'll have that discussion. I just wanted to follow up with, you know, the that. I don't want to confuse people with the liability insurance issue of the inspector. So,
Chair.
Representative Krieger.
Well, we had the hearing some time back. I remember we had the young man come in. I think he was $375,000 to construct the house and $500,000 to take it apart, get rid of the mold, lost his house, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
I was right in the process of building a house. So it kind of did wake me up, and I talked to some contractors, and my son-in-law was actually doing the work. He refused to use Tyvek on the coast. The horror stories that he ran into as a contractor and having to go and tear it out, take complete all the siding off, replacing studs, everything else. So we did, I think part of it is educating the person who's going to have a house built so they understand how to question some of those things with their contractor. Mm. So when they get a building permit, they go for that. That's where we need to have something given to them so they know some of the things to be looking for and questioning their contractor. We refuse to put that on. The stick frame stuff on two stories, 2x6, one up, and it was like 2 weeks before I let them put the plywood on. I would not have any composite material, all those strand stuff that you're talking about in that house. Everything that was first class I wanted, because I started to realize what that was going to be, the value of that house. It was like 16 months before the insulation went in. That house was dry, and it took us longer. But I think the fact that a lot of these large companies, especially, I don't think it's as much the small contractor that takes 6-8 months to build a house. It's those ones that you got a crew in there, 30 guys, and every 2 weeks they've done or got a house pounded out. You do that on the coast in a development in the winter, you're going to have moisture.
Mm.
And so I think a lot has to do with when they do it, the type of material they use. And I actually think the contractors are becoming more aware of this moisture issue than they ever were just a few years ago.
Yeah, and I appreciate that, and I'm hopeful that you were a sophisticated consumer when you went there and recognized those things ahead of time. But most consumers are not that well educated on those specific issues because they're pretty technical, and that's why you hire a licensed contractor, assuming that they're, you know, really qualified in those areas to direct you to the right products and the right process. But anyway, are there any other questions? Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am not sophisticated in these areas, but I'm getting very nervous because we're building a house right now. So the rain does not throw me a whole lot. So in reading the materials, as I did last evening, I assumed that what you were saying, Pat, was that the city inspector would have to determine whether or not there was that 19%, and that's not the case.
That's
I'm
not
hearing.
The case, that's right.
So nobody has to verify that.
Chair Hovey, Representative, tell me that's correct. The builder is required to certify it, but there's not a third party interaction beyond any third party the builder may use in that process.
And to follow up on Representative Tomei's question, there is no prescribed way to verify that.
Well, Chair Hovey, the rule in the statute and national standards provide a range of acceptable best practices methods, including using kiln dry materials, ventilation, and those kinds of things. But there's nothing. You're correct. There's nothing prescribed that says they have to do that. And as Mr. Berry has indicated, you know, perhaps that's one of the things we need to take a look at is should we at least have the builder call out how did they assure that the standard was met?
Because if I'm correct, the Oregon residential specialty code doesn't spell out any way to determine that 19%.
Correct.
I could just look at the sky and go, pretty good. It's pretty dry, summertime, 19%. Sign off on it.
So, Mr. Chair, could I ask a follow-up question on that?
You bet.
So how would someone determine moisture meter testing? What is that? Does somebody put something in the wood to test that?
Yeah, Chair Holby, Representative told me there are moisture meters that are designed for that purpose that basically stick a probe into the wood and assess and measure its moisture content.
follow up. So I'm going to follow up.
Okay.
So, but what I'm hearing somebody say, that if there were water under the floor that would not be tested by the meter, then there still could be a lot of moisture theoretically.
Yeah, Chair Hovey, Representative Tomei, that's right. The bill dealt with the moisture of framing members, and certainly, you know, if you go all the way back to the issue of, well, there's mold in the house, what happened? You know, there are branches that go everywhere from how the house was built, whether it was dry, whether water got in afterwards. I had a little bit of a mold problem in my own house where the issue was a plumbing leak. And so, you know, you kind of run down each of those branches to what do you do to try to stop it. This effort deals with the dryness of one of the building components when the house was built, and is fairly narrowly focused at that. But Chair Hovey is exactly right. There are a whole range of other issues that aren't part of that.
Right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet. Thank you for your testimony, and I hope to have a work group on this issue shortly with a couple of the members off this committee, and certainly I want to have the home builders, and if a representative from the Building Codes Division may be helpful as well, and perhaps a few others, because I really would like to see some better ability for the consumer to, have a little better product potentially at the end of the day. We're not going to solve all these problems, and I don't think we're going to solve all these problems with any kind of legislation that we do, but I think we can definitely take a few steps in the right direction without a lot of cost, I would think. So we just got to get by your liability issue. So So with that, I appreciate your testimony, and up next I have on this same issue, Gary Wolcott and Vince Gallagher. What am I doing for time? This must have been 30 minutes.
I took our time, we were moving our houses after I saw that.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Welcome, gentlemen. If you could state your name and the association you represent for the record.
My name is Gary Wolcott. I'm with the National Association for Moisture Management. And Vince Gallagher, also from the National Association for Moisture Management. And the story you want me to make. Well, you know, we're real interested in the conversation you just had. We already have, our association already has the standards in place that you're looking for to make sure the consumer knows that the house they're buying is moisture and mold free. The test that we recommend runs $250 to $400 for a house. And it's very thorough. You were talking about wood, about floor, about various parts of the house. To make sure a house is moisture and mold free, it's a 100% test. You have to test all of the house, every part of it, from the drainage to the wood, the floors, etc. And our standards do that. Our standards would address shoddy construction in, let's say, drainage, or if there is a higher percentage of mold or moisture in your house than the 19%. But our concern is the consumer, and this, I assume, is your concern too. So many people are buying homes that even exist that have mold or moisture damage. The person you were talking about that testified, his name was Mark Hughes, and he had a house built, and he and his family moved into that house. And after a few months, they started getting sick. When we finally arrived on the scene, the house was a total loss. He lost everything. He could not afford to remediate the house or take care of it. The tests that we have, the standards that we have, would have caught that before his family moved in. I think that pretty much covers it.
Again, my name is Vince Gallagher. Thanks for the opportunity to speak with you. The main problems with mold are health and the structure itself. and the structure, we're addressing the structure fairly thoroughly. As the home builders group mentioned, the current system is checking the framing and such, but the sheathing that goes on it, anything like that, can be wet. If you're building in August and you're checking the moisture content and the dries wood, but the house isn't assembled correctly via flashing, if you have flashing going the wrong way, you have the potential for moisture intrusions, which leads to problems. So a broader look at the quality of the construction. I know within the Home Builders Association, I'm sure there are a majority of members that do great work. That doesn't mean every crew member carries it out correctly. The quality of oversight, I suppose, within the individual contractor makes a lot of difference of the quality of process. When you have that, when you have, let's say, the stereotypical quality contractor, I think a self-certification program should work well, because they're sending an experienced guy who looks at their work and says, this is well done. In the case of Mr. Hughes's property, it was a general contractor that hired subs to do most of the work, had very little oversight of the work that was going on, and when Mr. Hughes really understood what his problems were, that contractor was gone, out of business, and had reopened. And consequently, with that style of workmanship, the consumer had no protection, really. I'm sure he would have certified it if the regulation had been in place at that time. I'm sure he would have certified and given you a piece of paper that said it was in good condition. But in that case, it wouldn't have succeeded. The other side of this I'd mention real briefly, just to emphasize what we consider to be the values of protecting against moisture damage is the health side of it. One small statistic, something like 6 or 7% of the emergency room visits in the country are from asthma attacks. And mold spores in the air are a well-known trigger for asthma attacks. They guesstimate, I'm not sure who the statisticians are that generalized this, but that they could cut asthma-related, if you could truly do a magic wand and eliminate or greatly reduce mold in housing in the United States today, you could eliminate half of those emergency room visits of the 6 or 7% that are moisture-related and asthma-related. And that would be a tremendous savings in parents going to work instead of the hospital, kids going to school. The statistics on school days lost and such are just dramatic. So both health and the consumer protection of people buying and not understanding what it is they're buying. We've all lived in houses, but we don't understand flashing and the various things. I think as a professional structure, it's prudent to provide protection for consumers and set up some system that assures that the house is the quality that they are expected to produce and expecting to buy.
So I appreciate your testimony. I'd be curious if you could at some point provide us with what your organization recommends for in your standards as far as specific testing. What kind of testing do you think would be we get the most bang for our buck, I suppose? And understanding you think you can test and, have 100% surety that nothing exists. And I assume that you're talking about testing a finished product at the time, and where I think this particular concept is really aimed at having this test in the process, involved in the process of construction, so that it's caught before it is actually sealed in. So in light of that, I'd be interested to see what those standards that you're talking about.
We would definitely provide you those standards. Also, we'd be interested in working with your work group. You talked about forming a work group. We would love to be a part of that. But yes, we could do that. We'll make sure that you get them. Can we email them to you or
the committee administrator?
Okay,
would be great.
We'll do that. Yeah, absolutely. Great.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Any questions?
I have a quick question.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Previous testimony from Pat from DCVS was about new standards and product.
you know, there's as many situations as I guess there are houses. Princess Tomei will probably put a moat in around hers. I'm staying. But generally speaking, does the kind of engineering that Pat described in the new product, letting not, you know, a place for water to get out, in your experience, has that improved? Using that standard, have you been in enough houses, has that improved the mold situation? I mean, is it a good thing as far as you're concerned?
It absolutely should, yeah, yeah. What's been explained to me is that since World War II, the change in materials that are used in homes, going from a lath and plaster that most of us probably grew up in to a sheetrock, seals a bigger area. You know, it's a 4x8, no air intrusion, paper on it. That paper is organic food for mold. So if it holds moisture, it's got a food source set right there. Having in that, it wouldn't be the way that this would be struck, but if you had the outside siding, then you had the eighth-inch gap the gentleman mentioned, that would provide the drainage. Those kind of changes are important. I mean, just at the beach, they just changed codes for flashing from 6 inches to 9 inches. And that's a reaction to 6 inches, apparently it wasn't cutting it, that they were getting wind-blown moisture. If you think of it, a window 6 inches up, flashing, wind blowing on it, it would appear, and I'm not personally knowledgeable of this fact, but it would appear that they were experiencing damage from moisture being driven by the wind, the air pressure up. Yeah. So they changed. So codes have been adjusting as time goes by to the new materials. And it is progressive, a good thing. But there's, again, workmanship. You can design wonderful materials and assemble them, and if guys want to take off and watch the beavers on Saturday instead of work, they're going to not nail down the last piece. Will inspections be 100% successful in finding all those? I doubt it. I mean, I don't think you can obsess over 100%. You have to just make the improvements you can and move on.
Yeah, and Representative Gilliam, if you'll remember, this committee actually passed legislation to actually implement that space behind the plaster products, the stucco products called EFIS, and we banned the type of product that didn't have that space. And I think since that time, the Building Codes Division then took that same concept and instituted it in other types of siting as well, I believe.
But it sounds like it's sort of in effect.
Yes.
It's a positive wall.
Yeah, yeah. I think you weren't at that meeting, actually.
We came in late.
Probably came in late.
Okay, so we got to move on.
So anyway, I thank you very much for your testimony and certainly your input on this. I think it's...
And again, we do volunteer to help you with our work group.
So noted.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And those responsible duck watchers always...
Next up, committee, we're keeping with this particular theme and trying to address the same issue, but in a slightly different way. And so up next, we have Craig Smith, John Chandler, and Mark Jacobson. And I think Mr. Chandler has got a sit-in.
Thank goodness.
So we have the topic of building envelope warranties. And, of course, we all know that the building envelope is the sort of the exterior part of the house where the water intrusion gets in after the fact as opposed to before the fact. So with that, we'll start out with Mr. Smith. And I appreciate you being here and giving us a... expertise on this issue.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Craig Smith. I'm with the Construction Contractors Board. I appreciate the opportunity to be before you today. I'm going to provide you with a little bit of an overview of the idea of a building warranty, where you are right now with Oregon law. Tell you a little bit about what Construction Contractors Board is doing that's related to a building warranty and provide you with some suggestions for further improvements. A building warranty, as you probably know, this is a pretty common theory. The idea is that it's a contract essentially between you and the person that's selling you a product, that the person selling you the product is going to stand behind it. Here we're talking about the exterior shell or the envelope of the building. I think for the most part you should know that currently you have Oregon law that relates to that. On a little handout that I provided you, I reference 701.320, which is the residential mention of a warranty. And there, what Oregon law requires is for a home builder to provide an offer of a warranty to the original purchaser of a house. Conversely, with the commercial application, there's a little bit different law, and that's on the second page of this handout. You'll see that up towards the top. That's at 701.134. And there, it provides the requirement for the contractor to provide the owner with a 2-year warranty of the building envelope and penetration components against defect in materials. So it's a little bit different requirement. It's not an offer, it's an absolute warranty requirement. You should know that, and I think many of you have lived through the Task Force on Construction Claims and the 2007 session where you had some improvements to the regulatory environment. You've gone through that. You know that background, but I've included some handouts in this material in case you weren't around for that time. If you have questions, I can go back to that, but rather than go through that too much, what I plan on doing is suggesting to you how Oregon, on the residential side, provides some protection to consumers. The first protection is that 701.320 requirement. That's the requirement for a home builder to offer some form of warranty to the new buyer of a home. The second one is your contractor's board dispute resolution process. Now, that process is not a warranty, but it acts a little bit like that, and that's because it allows the consumer, obviously broader than just new homes, but it allows the consumer to file a complaint against the contractor. And what we do, of course, is go out to the homeowner's house, take a look at the problem. We offer a mediation service at no cost that about 1 out of 2 times is successful in resolving the dispute. That's huge. Now, the fact that that complaint goes against the contractor's license and that mediation service and ultimately the power of the CCB to require the contractor to fix the job, that power in and of itself suggests to a contractor their obligation is to fix problems with the house for at least a period of 1 year. So therein lies the, in some cases, misconception that there's currently a 1-year warranty requirement. It acts like a warranty, because if the contractor doesn't repair the defect within a year, they end up in the CCB process. CCB process isn't 100% successful. The 50% of the time where the matter is not mediated, we end up taking a look at the job. Sometimes we rule for the contractor. Sometimes we rule for the homeowner. In those situations where we're obligated to issue an order because the homeowner's been damaged, you'll find that the contractor's board issues about $6 to $8 million a year in orders against construction contractors. Of those, about half of those ultimately are paid. Of course, that begs the question, what about the other half? And that's the problem of the bonding or contractors filing for bankruptcy, and that happens. But in essence, you have quite a system already in place, and it takes care of almost all the problems except for a few hundred contractors a year out of the 40-some thousand that are currently operating. So what could you do to improve this process? You always are thinking about raising the bond. That was done, I think, just 2 or 3 years ago in this committee. You can look at that. Perhaps that might help some. You also could think about the possibility of requiring residential contractors to have a similar requirement to have a 2-year building envelope warranty. You'd need to have a discussion about that, of course, because there will be some cost involved there. I can't tell you for certainty what that would do to the cost of construction if there was a requirement of a warranty, but that's certainly something you perhaps can think of on down the road. The other thing you could do would be to extend the CCB process for longer than that 1 year. And you could limit that to just the building envelope. so that for 1 year, citizens could file against the entire house, but for the second year, they could file for just building envelope leakage. There would be an adverse effect to the cost of bonds, and you will want to consider that. The cost of bonds would go up. I can't tell you how much, but it probably would, and you can certainly get some experts out here to talk about that. You would also have some effect on your contractor's board. The amount of complaints that we'd process would be extended. I can't tell you precisely how many, but we'd want to give that some more thought. But those are two ideas that came to my mind when I was thinking about this process. Can I answer any questions?
Questions from the committee? Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Craig, I've been contacted by constituents in the last 6 months about, you know, one guy, the contractor, ran out and he wants it higher. Then I get called by contractors saying the bond's too high. Especially, I got called by a guy who does niche work. He modifies houses for ADA or for seniors. And he said his bonding requirement now is, you know, way too high for the kind of jobs he has. I don't have a solution. I'm new to this committee in this area. You want to protect the consumer, but you also want to put any more, especially in Central Oregon, builders out of work. I'm trying to go through this. The last page you gave us looks like it's got the bonding and financial requirements. Some of them do a percentage of what the house is worth. You know, we're just now, we've raised ours to a set amount, and the guy that walked, the contractor walked out on him, he doesn't, you know, he's out a lot of money. But then the guy that he's doing the small jobs, he says, I can't afford what they're requiring me to do now, too. So, your problem.
Chair Holvey and Wisnant, yes, that is my problem. And I think you put your finger on the problem. That is that's a balancing act. Oregon, as you'll, when you analyze what other states do, is probably has some of the highest bonding requirements in the nation. You probably don't want to go much higher. With regard to your contractor who does a small volume of work, we do have a category in the licensing system that would allow for a much reduced bond. And perhaps he's unaware of that. It would require that he not do more than $40,000 worth of business a year. But if it's a small contractor...
Mr. Chair. I think Craig is talking about that the job itself, not cumulative, but each job is a small amount compared to.
Chair Holvey, Representative Wynn, we haven't seen that the $20,000 bond is inappropriate because of small projects. My experience in construction was with small projects years ago, and those contractors, because they do a lot of volume, can end up causing a lot of grief. Here's what I can tell you about the cost of those bonds. The average cost of a $20,000 bond for a general contractor that has good credit is around $300. The cost of a $5,000 or $10,000 bond for a contractor with bad credit can be $5,000 to $10,000. So it really has to do with the credit history as opposed to the size of the bond.
Thank you, and I appreciate you talking to Representative Wisnant about that. This committee went painfully through the whole series of raising bonds and was a little bit controversial and was a little bit of a stretch, I think, for us to raise them as high as we did. I think we're sort of at that upper limit in my mind, and I'm not sure I want to see them go much higher, so I think we have to figure out other avenues to protect consumers, because oftentimes that bond fails to protect consumers anyway. So with that, Mr. Berry, comments on this one?
Thank you. Scott Berry with Oregon Home Builders. I'd just like to take a minute or two and kind of run through what we've done recently and kind of where we are in Oregon. We've got tested licensing for your initial license. We've got a one-year CCB system that is much like a warranty, as Mr. Smith just talked about. We've got a 10-year statute of repose where the contractor is liable We have mandatory liability insurance. We're one of only one or two states that has mandatory liability insurance, which is surprising to me. But as we looked at that issue, that was, I think, something we were both surprised about. Mandatory bond for the warranty period or for the CCV period, which is, again, much like the warranty period. Mandatory continuing ed on codes, on now on building envelope training, which gets, I think, at a lot of the moisture issues we just talked about. So that's mandatory for all contractors. We have current construction law that's also mandatory for contractors. And we have a dispute resolution process during that one-year period that's free to consumers as long as they have a legitimate claim. They pay an initial, I think it's $50 fee, and then that comes back to them if their claim was a legitimate claim. So I'd put Oregon against any state of the nation when you put all of that stuff together in terms of protection for the consumer. Is it perfect? No. Can we tweak things to make it better in moisture and potentially here? We might be able to. But keep in mind how well we do right now in the state. And unfortunately, you're never going to be able to get the bad contractors, the bad folks in any profession completely out. That's unfortunate, and we all have to, at some point, wear that by coming and dealing with these issues.
Thank you for that comment. The reality check is that we will never completely solve all these problems when we have contractors who are able to get away with it as such. And certainly, I think Mr. Smith sort of alluded to that. Of course, we have the issues with contractors who, the bond doesn't cover it, and they just walk away. And which leads me to a slight follow-up question, I guess. They declare bankruptcy generally, and then they pop up in some other entity formation to become a contractor again. So I'm curious. We have some sort of restrictions about licensing people who have gone through bankruptcy, or not bankruptcy, but who have gone through a complaint and around shoddy construction and basically got out from underneath it somehow. Can you just elaborate on the difference between filing for bankruptcy and being able to get away from your debt and your debt to the consumer or to other vendors, and then being able to get a new license, and why that happens, and then also what you are able to do kind of in that same picture?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, what we're talking about here, of course, is the problem of a contractor running one business down into the ground and then turning over and starting a brand new company. And we've got a couple of tools to take care of that. The first one is that when we license a corporation or an LLC, we take a look and identify each of the owners of that business, and we cross-check previous construction debts that we have on file to see if this new business entity has an owner or operator that has been responsible for a previous debt that goes unpaid. That's a debt that we have adjudicated or that we are aware of. And that costs us time and money, but that keeps contractors from doing just that, starting a corporation, running it into the ground, and then starting a new one. So that problem has been addressed. The issue of a contractor that files bankruptcy and constitutionally has the right to start over, of course, that's a constitutional issue. And when a business files bankruptcy, it's the obligation of the state to pay attention to that requirement, and we're not able to keep that person, that individual, from starting a new business. However, we are able to take a look and see if the business practices of this new business entity and having an individual who's been involved in a past problem should have higher bond requirements. And when we see a situation that the law allows us to do an increased bond requirement for this new company because the owner had problems before, we do require that larger bond.
So I have one follow-up question for either one of you. Since we adopted the law that requires the home builder to offer a warranty, I think that was in 2007, do we have any data on how many new, not that there's a lot of data out there probably in this economy, but do we have any data on how many or what percentage of homes that have been, new homes have been built and actually have warranties?
Chair Holby, Scott Berry again with the Oregon Home Builders. Most, if not all, of our builders offer a one-year warranty that's typically separate and outside of the Construction Contractors Board. Many of those go through, and some even refer to the Contractors Board as dispute resolution, not just for the first year, but even can offer that as a dispute resolution process going forward. In terms of a third-party warranty, like a 1-10 product, my understanding is the penetration is somewhere around 10-15%. That product is currently the product that I believe is required in New Jersey, which I think is the only other state that has a mandatory warranty requirement of the 50 states.
May I follow up on that?
Representative Riley.
And does that warranty cover the moisture envelope? Is that part of that warranty?
Chair Holby, Representative Riley, I don't know that it is. I know that it, typically my understanding is that 2 years is the additional of HVAC, plumbing, mechanical stuff, and the 10 years is typically structural, but there's a number of policies out there, some may, some may not. I'm not 100% sure. Mr. Chandler is kind of more of our warranty expert, and he is out of state.
It's hiding.
I won't comment on that. I hope he's having a good time. I appreciate that. I mean, obviously, a 2-year building envelope warranty, I think, is probably minimal, but I still think it would be a step in the right direction, you know, because a lot of those moisture problems don't crop up until 5 or 6 years later. So, you know, but it might catch some of the more severe problems right off the bat. So, anyway, I appreciate your testimony. I'm going to move on to the next speaker. Mr. Jacobson, I think.
Yes. Chair Holby, what a memory. Of the committee. Excuse me. First, I apologize for passing out my materials a little too quickly. I jumped the gun, was a little anxious to speak. My name is Mark Jacobson. I'm with Jacobson Risk Management. I'm a risk management consultant for architects and engineers working primarily on developing best practices and ways to avoid moisture intrusion and other problems in buildings. You may recall I testified before this committee in 2007 in relation to the recommendations of the Construction Claims Task Force, and at that time I introduced the idea of taking a model that has been very successful, and that's the third-party warranty program in British Columbia, and bringing it to Oregon. The Construction Claims Task Force looked at that and was concerned about the mandatory nature of the warranty. Currently, there are no insurers in the United States that provide coverage like the insurers do in British Columbia. There are 5 warranty providers in British Columbia, though. There are insurers who will provide the insurance. My testimony last time focused on the virtues of considering a voluntary program. And from my perspective as a consultant to architects and engineers and working with developers and contractors, the practices with respect to the building envelope, a lot of them Mr. Berry just referred to, the practices are evolving, the best practices to avoid the problems. The market is pushing it. If you have to sit through one of these large construction defect litigation lawsuits, you are motivated to find a better way to deal with it. And I believe voluntary third-party warranty is a solution. It's essentially, what I'm proposing is legislation that would lay the foundation for an insurance provider to come to Oregon and offer warranties. And I think the market's there to buy them. I don't want to go into too much detail. I provided you with a lot of materials there, but there are a couple of examples. There are state agencies right now trying to develop best practices to avoid building envelope problems in state-funded and state buildings. And I've been fortunate enough to do a little work with one of those agencies. The problem is that that agency is doing the same work that private developers are doing, that nonprofit affordable housing providers are doing. And each one of them is going to have to develop, implement, and administer the program for themselves independently. A common solution would be for all of those concerned parties to say, we want a building envelope warranty on our project. If you're going to receive funding from us, if you're going to do a project for us, you must provide a building envelope warranty. Now, right now, they can't do that because the product doesn't exist in Oregon. Going over the material I provided you, this is new since the last time. The Homeowner Protection Office in BC is now published statistics. And I've provided you with the latest statistics. And some of these statistics address specifically what Mr. Smith and I don't think Mr. Berry talked about contractors going bankrupt. But in British Columbia, in 2008 and 2009, they had 250, 260 claims where the builder was unable to rectify the situation. Could be the builder's gone, bankrupt, whatever. The warranty provider stepped up and solved the problem. There was a backstop. There was a guaranteed source of funds. It was 169 times in 2008 and 89 times in 2009. So I provided you with the statistics. It shows how the number of claims relative to the number of residential housing units. In BC, the program is limited to residential. I don't think that warranty insurance in Oregon necessarily needs to be limited to residential. Anybody who wants to purchase a warranty that covers the building envelope ought to be able to do it. Representative Krieger, I think that would have solved your problem on the coast. You could have said, I want with my building, because I'm aware of these concerns, I want a guarantee that I'm not going to have a building envelope problem for a period of 5 to 10 years. And those are available under the program in British Columbia. So what I've also provided for you is a document that's been published by the Homeowners Protection Office, the Guide to Home Warranty Insurance in British Columbia. It's a pretty good document describing their program, describing the coverage. And I've also provided the statistics. And then, you know, I had a month or a two-month period where I didn't have a lot to do, so I tried my hand at crafting legislation, and I drafted what I think legislation would look like. I used the Homeowner Protection Act in BC as a model, and then I applied elements of the Washington State Qualified Warranty Statute to try to draft legislation that I think has the appropriate elements necessary to encourage insurance providers to think, okay, maybe Oregon is a place where we can introduce a new product in the United States. So, like I said, I've given you a lot to look at. It's kind of a new, different way of looking at the problem, looking for maybe a single source insurance company that would develop its own risk management, risk assessment program, would develop its own criteria for determining whether it's going to issue the warranty, and then would issue the warranty if that criteria is met. And I think that's all I have. I would be happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Well, not having had time to look at any of this material, it's pretty hard to ask a question, I think. But, you said one thing that just kind of, I'd just like a little clarification on. So if in a hypothetical world, if we were to actually adopt that kind of a warranty, voluntary warranty possibility, would the whoever was issuing that warranty, the insurance company or whatever, would they have to have you said they'd have to have criteria that would have to be met by the builder in order for them to issue the warranty?
There are two models. There are two ways that these programs develop. There's the risk engineered model, where the warranty provider the big issue is the envelope. You can buy the 210 warranties elsewhere. The big issue is the envelope. With a risk engineered provider, the provider would work with the envelope consultant that it trusts, that it has faith in. It would develop its own design standards and guidelines for different environments, different climates, different exposures. It would require that those design guidelines be met. It would have its third-party consultant drop in on the project periodically, participating in the design development to make sure that appropriate systems are in place. Would drop in the construction documents to make sure the appropriate detailing is taking place, and then would drop in during construction to make sure that appropriate site observation is taking place, testing, etc. When its consultant signs off on the project, the warranty provider issues the warranty.
Sorry to interrupt you, but so this kind of criteria then would overlay the building codes essentially, but would have a separate third-party person, I would assume, from the insurance industry come out and inspect to make sure those criteria were met?
It would develop its risk assessment process. The part of the difficulty with relying on the building code, particularly in Oregon, is if you look at a map of the climates that we're exposed to in Oregon, there are a couple that I've seen that building envelope consultants have showed me. Oregon's got five different climates. It's the only state in the Union that goes from the coast to the high desert. Mm-hmm. And the building code by itself, without careful thought, is not an adequate guide to assure by itself that you're going to meet every condition that you meet when you're constructing something in Oregon.
Yeah. So, well aware of the building code issues. It's they're basically guidelines for builders to build by, and not necessarily does your plan check review and inspection process guarantee that they all happen.
And what they do, because I don't want to suggest that they're deficient, the modifications in the last few years have put more responsibility on the design professionals to provide more details and to exercise professional judgment to adapt the base code and the base requirements to the conditions that they meet. And that's where you get into more technical envelope consulting as well. The architects need to rely on somebody that may have a little more knowledge than they do about certain things.
Well, Representative Tomei, a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, if I could ask a series of maybe two or three, I'll be fast.
Okay, you got 2 or 3 minutes for an answer.
Great. So, I assume then the insurance would be bought before the house was being built. Is that correct?
Chair Holvey, Representative Tomei, in the way the system works now in British Columbia, the warranty company has to be satisfied that the building has been designed and constructed before the warranty insurance is bound.
So you would have to approve of the architect and of the builder, in a sense.
Chair Holby, Representative Tomei, it is more rather than approving of the the way I've drafted the legislation and the way they do it in British Columbia, the warranty provider has a broad discretion in evaluating the folks that it's going to write a warranty for. Has the developer done a project like this before? Has the architect done a project like this before? Maybe we'll go look at them. Let's see how they're holding up.
Third question. So it seems to me you're having inspectors come at several times during the process of the building, and so you're going to do that for between 200. Do I remember you saying that, or was that somebody else? $250 to $400.
Chairman Holby, Representative Tomei, in British Columbia, my familiarity is with a provider that provides these warranties on typically large multifamily residential projects. And the way the process works there is, on your large project, you pay an application fee, you pay a processing fee. So, you know, on your $50 million project, maybe you have a $15,000 or a $25,000 processing fee that takes, that covers the cost of the administrative expense, and then there's an additional charge per door. And my understanding is that it is as low as $200 to $500 a door. Now, I'm not familiar with the pricing for example, single-family residential in British Columbia, where the warranties are also required.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. That was a good question. I'd be curious about what that cost is that they're doing on single-family dwellings. So, all interesting information. I appreciate all your input and your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, committee. We are now up to a very exciting moment in our committee. It's because Representative Nancy Nathanson is here to give us a presentation on the Task Force on Effective and Cost-Efficient Provision of Government Services. And it's also the last item on our agenda, which makes it sort of exciting as well.
How many days is this testimony?
So I think I guaranteed the committee they would be out of here by 4 o'clock, and I don't think that we'll have any problem with that, as I seem to be right on schedule. So with that, Representative Nathanson, if you introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Nancy Nathanson, State Representative from District 13. And with your permission, I'd like to ask one of the task force members to join me in case there are comments or questions that something I've forgotten or can't handle. Sarah Miller.
Oh, certainly. Certainly. And I really appreciate the neck paraphernalia that you have around your neck. So...
Representative Nathanson has paraphernalia? I don't understand.
if there were other people that were going to testify in front of this committee, they should take note, you know.
Mr. Chair, you promised something exciting. Maybe it's already starting with a little new kind of interest. I'd like to start out by giving you a brief overview of what the committee was about and the emphasis for it before I get into the recommendations. The committee was comprised of 21 individuals, and right from the get-go, it was my hope, I was just determined that this was going to show a state and county collaboration. So the membership included 4 elected state legislators and 4 elected local government legislators, 2 Senate, 2 House members, 3 county commissioners, and 1 mayor. I wanted to set the tone right from the beginning that we're talking about a new era of partnership in government, not what does one government do to or because of the other. But we need to be doing this together and talking together about how to solve problems. The second thing I want to mention is because of my interest in technology and doing things better and more efficiently, I was sort of pushing the boundaries of things, and I was very appreciative that legislative administration, legislative council, Department of Administrative Services, and others met with me to make sure that we could do what I wanted to do and maybe set the stage for future committee work, do it within the parameters of Oregon's public meetings law and public records law. We conducted our meetings. Every meeting was available through web-based audio and video participation as well as in person. So we used technology that way, and although the legislative branch was unable to afford me the space and the technology to manage committee information online, my legislative assistant and I just came up with a way to go basically around, go around a roadblock that we found, and we just did our own stuff. Our committee operates online. All of our stuff was posted before meetings. All the background materials that we were going to be considering was available to the public and available to committee members before the meeting, or if something came up at the meeting, it was posted later. So I'm very pleased about that and hope that we can sort of push the legislative branch into the future, which the rest of the world is already there. The impetus for this was back in my the first term that I served in the legislature, two kinds of things happened, and I put them together in my head and realized we have to do something bigger and different. First of all, we were hearing from counties about the dire consequences of the potentially imminent discontinuation of federal payments to the timber-dependent counties. There was a governor's task force on federal timber payments. I read every page of that big document. They had 53 recommendations what to do when the counties were no longer receiving these federal payments. More than half of the recommendations said something about the state should do this, or the state should do that, or the state should pay for it. I was really struck by that. The state, the state, the state. Yet this was a document about what counties were going to be doing. So we were faced with an imminent financial crisis. We sort of dodged that bullet for a little while, but the story isn't over yet. We don't know what's going to be happening to the counties, and some of the reports I'm hearing are that the first serious county fiscal crisis may hit next July of 2011, and three or four other counties may follow in July of the following year. There are very serious things that may be happening out there in counties, but that means we as a state will have some responsibilities that fall to us. So I believe it's our responsibility working on our own budget challenges as well as those of counties to talk with counties about how can we just do things differently and meet the demands for services. The second part of the impetus for this was, as a member of Ways and Means and several Ways and Means subcommittees as well as joint Ways and Means, I would hear presentations from all sorts of departments. And these presentations were remarkably similar. Different departments were doing different things that were linked together. They'd want funding for certain things when it was in the same or overlapping program areas, but it was disconnected. We don't do program-based budgeting. We do budgeting in silos. Well, the same thing happens in counties. So there are a lot of programs where the state has some responsibilities, and it turns out maybe two or three or four different state agencies have some responsibility in this general program area, whether it's water quality or children's services or job training. You'll find pieces of this sort of thing in multiple state agencies, and then counties are running their own shows too. Sometimes one or more departments in 36 different counties in Oregon are also doing the same stuff. And then the private entities who are actually running those programs or services have to ask for funding from the county, and some of them operate in more than one county. So they're asking for funding from one or more counties, they're asking for funding from more than one state agency, and then they're subject to annual audits by every one of those entities. The audits come at different times of year, requesting similar but slightly different pieces of information, and would you please fill it out with a green pencil on this form and with a blue pencil on that form. I mean, it's just our bureaucracy is bringing us down. I wanted to address that, too. So, with bipartisan support, House Bill 2920 passed and provided a charge for a task force to look at four specific program areas, plus a fifth area which had been identified by the Federal Forest Payments Task Force, and that is how were the counties going to be planning for services during this fiscal crisis. So our committee, our task force began meeting in November 2009. I believe we had only seven meetings of the full task force. We organized ourselves into subcommittees, five subcommittees, and those subcommittees met periodically. And in that short space of time, the committee came up with 23 separate recommendations for doing things better and doing things differently. I asked for this task force with zero funding because I knew it was, frankly, the only way I could get it through the Ways and Means process. But if we could accomplish all of that with no funding, meaning I had no staff available to me to help do the work of this task force, it was done all out of carving out of our time, our legislative office time, carving little tiny bits of time out of people who were on the task force. Maybe they could beg some time from someone else to help. If we could accomplish all of that with no funding, can you imagine what we could accomplish with a little bit more effort? I'd like to read to you a few comments that were made in our last task force. Secretary of State Kate Brown, who was a member of our task force, said what we were doing was very complementary to what is happening in her agency. Quote, there is amazing work in this report in terms of what I would call improving processes, and I am hopeful that the chair and at least some of the folks in this room will be moving forward in sort of a 2.0 version, what I would call a redesign. And I think that's really where state government needs to be going. I think there are pieces happening, obviously, in the governor's reset report, but I hope that this chair would lead the next conversation, and that is truly redesign. Chris Brown, superintendent of Oregon State Police, said, there's so much potential and there's so many opportunities out there if we just have more time and can focus a little more energy. And I think there are some wonderful things to come if we can continue this effort. And finally, a comment from Mayor Denny Doyle. I found this really encouraging. It's that there is another step of breaking down barriers between different organizations and different entities within a form of government. That's a huge step forward. It's a small one we've taken, but I think we've demonstrated it's pretty safe when you work together. And that's something that we have to change in government from top to bottom, large to small. So that's the spirit in which we worked together, I think, from the very beginning of our meetings. So now I'd like to tell you quickly what some of those recommendations are that have now been formally adopted. The report will be published in a week or so.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. Will this be available to hand out, Representative, or do you have a...
Yes.
We'll probably get it in a week or so.
Yeah, the report is being finished right now. The task force adopted it officially about 1 week ago, and we're putting the last edits. There were a few editorial changes.
Things you're going to read us? We don't have a view graph or anything? You don't have a handout of that?
You didn't have the budget for that.
We actually have it posted online, though.
I
don't know if the committee administrator can project something on the screen, but we can show you how to get to our...
But we're all dying to know if one of those 23 included anything about background checks.
Yeah.
So we now have 24.
That was our first topic today.
Well, show them our webpage and then get to the webpage. Can we do it from there? My legislative assistant, Dorothy Waller, is going to show you our website.
Yay, Dorothy.
By the way, we did it through Google because we can't do it through the legislature's website yet. I'm hopeful. I'm a nag on that topic.
Oh, yeah.
So we'll get some permission for the internet. Well, I will go ahead and start.
Go ahead and start. Yeah, we don't.
Okay.
We can read faster than you can talk, I bet.
One of our.
No.
One of,
no. I know that's a bad bet.
One of our areas was assessment and taxation. We have a Department of Revenue that's involved in, you might say, taxation business, but also in assessment of large corporate parcels, but also is in communication with the county assessors and recorders all the time to accomplish business. And it had occurred to me, well, we have 36 separate operations going on in the counties, and we've got this big operation going on in the state. How are they linked? Are there better ways to work together? So that group came up with 6 recommendations. Some of them, it's like low-hanging fruit, but until you take the time to do it. Oh, and here's our website, by the way. So here,
so go back. Go back one. Got the site.
So here's, and you can find all of our agendas and minutes online if you fish around on there, find out who's a member of the committee, who the technical advisors were. Yeah, but do we have that list of 23 things? Oh, good. That's what I'm reading from right now. And how to scroll down just a bit. Okay, so on assessment and taxation, part of the low-hanging fruit was, believe it or not, we have to change some statutes to make sure that we can do some of our processes through electronic means instead of hard copy.
Really?
This isn't all just administrative rule. We actually are going to process some changes in statute just to catch up to the 21st century.
9 of
them. My gosh, thank you. So as pointed out, we have 9 different statutes we've got to change just to do things better.
Huh.
Now, why these weren't recommended to us before in little bits and pieces, I can't tell you, but I'm glad we found them now. This one group ferreted these out in no time. Can you imagine what we could do if we had a little more time? So we're going to transform hard copy manual processes to electronic automated processes. Eliminate requirement for farm board review of farm values. You can read. There are 6. One of them that I want to point out, recommend changes to exemptions, requirements, and processes. I'd like to tell you what that's about. The assessment and taxation group discovered this, but then when they brought the recommendation to the full task force, we realized that this problem happens across the board in many, many program areas. The Department of Justice has been doing some talking about this, and the Secretary of State's office has been doing some talking about this. We're between the 3 of us pushing, we better get this fixed. Over the years, there have been separate requests for certain kinds of information about individuals, judges, police officers, other persons in certain kinds of roles, for certain of their personal information not to be made public. It's exemption from public disclosure. So it's related to public records law, and it's related to privacy and some other different things. Over the years, every time there's a need that's described, there's been a separate one-off statute developed. Well, let's exempt the person in this category and their spouse, or this person, their spouse, and their children, or this person only. In some cases, it was to exempt an address and a phone number. Maybe in another case, all they mentioned was the address. You know, it wasn't uniform what was getting exempt from disclosure. It wasn't uniform who was exempt. And there were no uniform processes for when the person is no longer serving in that role. Then how do you remove that exemption? It's pretty messy, and it's in many, many statutes. We don't have an overall comprehensive rule, but the problem is in the counties with the county recorders and clerks and with the state offices, there are books really, really thick with separate individual pages of a different process you do for each person, and you have to remember to do it, and then you're supposed to remember to go undo it. It's a real mess. It causes a lot of time. It's a big aggravation. It needs to get fixed. That's assessment and taxation. In the, I'd like to skip down to criminal justice area and tell you about a couple of fun things we discovered. Now, the criminal justice area is very interesting to me because this is an area with, in some ways, a more military-type structure of command, and reporting. Protocol matters a lot, you know, and there's a lot of turf protection in my observation. Well, we do this, they do that, and we're not going to change this. And each entity, whether it's the local cops or the county sheriff or the state police, they're each very clear on roles and responsibilities. And in some cases, you have then other elected officials, whether it's district attorneys or elected sheriffs. And, you know, from one county to another, they do things differently. You have a few counties where commissioners are also judges and so forth. Well, it just gets interesting. Who's willing to work together and who's not? But you know what? When that subcommittee met with representatives from cops, sheriffs, judges, you know, run the gamut, they discovered some stuff they're doing that they are eager to cooperate on. For example, county jails, the counties have a system of inspecting jails. It's sort of a peer review system, and there are dozens, if not a few hundred, different criteria that they review and inspect jails on. It's a very rigorous inspection and audit procedure for county inspection of jails. It was discovered that because of a statute that we have, the state is required to perform an audit of county jails. The state audit is much less thorough than the county audit. They audit on only a certain limited number of things, but the state is required to take time away from the Department of Corrections to go do these county audits that have already been done. So should we consider changing that and not do it anymore? That's going to be your recommendation. Obviously, this committee, this task force doesn't make decisions, but they uncovered things that they're going to bring forth to the next legislative assembly as recommendations to simplify and reduce cost, and the point is to reduce cost for both the state and the counties. In many instances, it really is reducing costs on both sides, yet not jeopardizing services, accountability, or outcomes for citizens. That's another thing that we want to be very clear on. So there are five recommendations in the criminal justice area, two in the area of elections, three recommendations in human services. And instead of going into all the detail of each recommendation, I'd like to leave time for your questions. The point is, I'm very excited about what the outcome of this group was, working together. When you have local and state partners, elected officials as well as appointed officials, and people like Ms. Miller who work in the department trying to accomplish what the state has said you're supposed to do, and sometimes you probably look at this and say, why are we still doing it this way? But their hands are tied. When you get everybody at the table together talking, you can figure out some new ways of delivering service. And I think it's imperative that we start doing things differently. So this is one start. I also, I guess, would like to clarify that the difference between the governor's reset cabinet and what this task force did is the reset cabinet focus was state government. The focus of this task force was the intersection of those services and program areas that are shared state and local government, which it turns out there are dozens.
Thank you for that overview. I think it was very very enlightening, and I look forward to some of those recommendations and whatever this committee can do to help and discuss those and see if there's something we can get accomplished this next session. I will definitely be working with you on that.
Thank you,
and,
Mr. Chair.
With that, are there any questions?
I just wanted to ask if the administrator could get us email us the site here.
If you got the materials from yesterday that I sent, I'll send it again. But I said it was part of the materials package I sent.
Got
yesterday.
It. Never mind.
Mm-hmm. Representative Wisdom. Thank you, and thank you very much, Representative. Great job. Remember, I sent you a letter. One of the issues, and I didn't see you address that specifically. Did your task force discuss the property, delinquent property tax rate that Oregon charges?
No, we determined that the rate was a policy issue, and we were focused on process and design. How can we do things differently rather than looking at things like the rules or the rates?
Couple quick ones?
Sure.
Could you go back to the beginning? One of those you said 2013 instead of 2011. You're going to recommend changes to requirements and process to the...
Oh, okay.
I can help. That was my
Thank
subcommittee.
You.
Chair Holvey, Representative Wisnett. For the record, Sarah Miller, I'm the Policy and Planning Division Administrator at Business Oregon. I have been on the task force with Representative Nathanson, and I sat as the other state representative on the Assessment and Taxation Subcommittee with Director Elizabeth Harchenko. This item came out of our Assessment and Taxation Subcommittee relative to exemptions in the property tax system, but as Representative Nathanson spoke to, it's not just a property tax issue. And so I believe that the technical recommendation from the subcommittee is a report to the legislature that authorizes a cross-agency group to bring back legislation for 2013.
Okay.
It didn't seem like The policy question is so large that it couldn't be addressed intelligently in legislation that agencies could execute on in preparation for the 2011 session. The county auditor who brought this item to our attention walked into a subcommittee meeting one day, no joke, with a 5-inch binder, had 1,200 pages in that were instruction to his staff on how to process
that
exemptions.
That makes sense. Okay. Follow on.
No joke. It's very big.
So how many recommendations did we have?
23.
Okay, and then 24 is going to background check. Going to be the background checks. How about another one? You talked to the Secretary of State, and I've had good relationship with the Secretary of State, but this new requirement that our deal where they raised the set to our voter pamphlet to $750 or 300 signatures. It didn't take me long to get 300 signatures, but that put more work on the county clerks with no money.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
They had to go in and verify and do all the work. So if it had been 400, I'd have probably paid the 400, but I went out and got my 300 signatures. I mean, so we gave the clerks more work and didn't give them any money to do that. And finally, you mentioned about the inspection. I've got a business in Redmond who sells meat nationwide. And he's complaining because he's got a county health office inspector in there, a state inspector in there, and a federal inspector in there.
Yes.
So, thank you.
Interesting.
Could I respond
Comment?
Quickly? Yes. We've noticed some of those same things, and I would like to mention that as a result of the recommendations from the subcommittees, the task force adopted 5 recommendations as a task force of the whole. One of them is to establish fiscal impact guidelines for statutes affecting local governments. We recognize that we can't force this to happen, but it's now my responsibility as chair of the task force to raise this issue with legislative leadership to consider, just like we do fiscal impact on state agencies, to do fiscal impact on local governments. Now, apparently there has been an attempt to do that. Often the local government doesn't respond in time to have something included in material that is being provided, but we do want to raise this issue. But it also raises another concern, which is we can be very optimistic about what our intentions are, but then To change the legislature's own common practices is going to take a while because we're used to doing things a certain way, and we need to absorb it into our culture also of how we do business. Here's a really good bill idea, but did we consider that it's going to make this department do such and such, or this count, all the 36 counties have to do that? It will take a while for us then to absorb our responsibility with regard to our partners.
questions. I think you've hit on something that we touched on earlier with our background check discussion, is that it's another case where we have silos in every agency doing the same program, and at a great expense to the state. And so we don't know how successful we'll be getting through this in 2011 and coming up with something that actually changes that. But I think our committee is going to endeavor to make that happen, which would be an interesting cost savings perhaps to the state and potentially to counties, because I hadn't thought about, you know, including local government into that background check issue, where everybody is out there doing their own separate little background checks, and so it's an interesting development. So, really appreciate your time. Representative Smith, question?
Yeah, just praise and a plug slash question. The praise is, you know, thank you. There's no, I think every member of the committee knows, there's no real natural constituency for this. There's no sort of interest group. There's no donor set. There's not a heck of a lot of press attention, you know, but but we're all
clear
constituencies.
Room.
Right? Yeah, exactly. I mean, luckily the throngs come in, right? The League of Women Voters is here in force, you know. And also applaud on the GovSpace thing. I mean, just you pushing, you know, just you doing that has already gotten at least two other, you know, work groups or task force that I'm aware of more comfortable with the notion of not waiting until we can be around wooden thrones to communicate about things very slowly. So yay for that. My plug slash question is us thinking about the connective tissue on the various kind of good government stuff we've got going, right? There's the Committee on Performance Excellence. I don't know all of all the status on that, but I know they met relatively recently. There's the transparency stuff we're trying to do. There's the progress forum stuff, progress board stuff that we may try to do again with the Secretary of State's office. There's a proposal before this committee on the core functions of government in the special session. There's the IT work group stuff. And any thoughts you have of which pieces, you know, now or later, which pieces are, you know, sort of overlappable versus which things are truly better left in their own conversations? Because it's a lot of conversations about one thing that maybe should be divided on.
And that's a really good comment, because Representative Smith, and it's something that, you know, I've been aware of, and it's very difficult to, you know, rein in all those different pieces that are being talked about, because a lot of them do overlap, but they all have sort of a different focus. But it's my hopes that this committee will, you know, at some point in next session sort of get a handle on maybe part of that. I don't know if we're going to be able to get through all of it, but that's my hopes, is to really get a handle on what all is going on around government accountability, and so we can really make an intelligent decision about the direction. But this piece is extremely important. I see a county representative in the room as well, so you know, it is extremely important, and really appreciate it. There was no, I didn't see anything on the future of boards and commissions in there. Okay, just thought I'd check. So I appreciate your time, your effort, and look forward to working with you and your task force. Thanks so much for all the work you put into this. And I think it really is sort of exciting for us to look at state government and local government and our services a little bit differently.
Thank you so much.
So, committee, I've done a little bit ahead of 4 o'clock, so we have about another 25 minutes for me to talk.
Oh, really?
Oh, wow.
Sorry.
Could I say something before we adjourn?
Representative Tomei.
I really look forward to come to this committee for one reason, and one reason only, is the cookies that Cindy provides for us.
Is that you,
Thank
Cindy,
you,
that does
Cindy.
That?
Yay!
Thank you very much. Thank you. It's hard to resist eating those.
It should be pointed out three would be better.
I have no idea.
I was thinking about it. You know what? This would be a great way to get back to
So with that, I'll adjourn the interim committee on consumer protection and government accountability.